Welcome to the Conversations Politics podcast from Canberra. I'm Michelle Grattan. This week has seen rioting at the Manus Island Detention Centre, which cost the life of one asylum seeker from Iran, and saw many others injured, a number of them quite seriously. The incidents have brought back to public attention some of the human costs of Australia's tough border protection policy, which is, however, having success in stopping the boats, with no arrivals now for a couple of months. Today we're talking with Labor's Immigration and Border Protection spokesman, Richard Marles. Labor brought in the PNG solution and laid the groundwork for this government's really tough policy that does appear to be working. What now are the differences between Labor's policy and the government's policy on border protection generally?
Well, I think what is in common is that both the Abbott government and ourselves see the importance of the PNG arrangement. And whilst you will hear a lot of talk and noise from the Abbott government, quite frankly, the most important thing they have done is to continue to prosecute the PNG arrangement, which Labor put in place, because it, more than anything else, is what has seen a reduction in the boats coming from Indonesia to Christmas Island, and obviously as a result of that has seen a reduction in the number of people who have drowned at sea. In terms of the events that have occurred over the last few days, it's hard to assess exactly what's happening at Manus Island and exactly what the government's doing. They're not a particularly open government when it comes to telling people what they're doing with asylum seeker policy. And I actually think what we do need now is a full and open inquiry at arm's length, which gets to the bottom of why Manus Island isn't working at the moment.
But of course your critics say, well, in government, when there was rioting on Nauru, Labor didn't call an independent inquiry.
Well, actually, when there was rioting and there were issues at both Christmas Island and Villawood, that's exactly what we did with the Hawke-Williams review, which was an independent review after a series of very serious events. And I think that is something of a model for what this government ought to do now. And a lot was learnt from that review. You see, one of the things I think, Michelle, is that this culture of secrecy has a degree of arrogance about it. It's not just about refusing to tell Australian people what's going on, and there's something wrong, obviously, in that itself, but it closes the door for other people, for an outside set of eyes, to provide some insight and to give some contribution to how things might be done better. I mean, at the end of the day, we have public debate in a democracy because you get better answers through that process. And I think we do need an outside set of eyes to have a good look at why Manus Island appears to be melting down on Minister Morrison's watch, because we simply cannot afford for this facility to fall over.
What would you be doing in government that's different to now, though generally in border protection policy?
Well, I think there is one broad area of difference in terms of the asylum seeker issue. There are some differences in terms of the way in which those people who are currently in Australia are being treated. We obviously have a difference in relation to temporary protection visas, as an example. We don't support that. But if you're looking at the question of the problem of stopping boats coming from Indonesia to Christmas Island, I do think that we see this as a much more regional issue, and we put a lot more effort into managing our relationships with Malaysia, with Indonesia, and of course in the Pacific with PNG and Nauru. And when you look at the way in which this government's going about its relationship with Indonesia particularly, to me it's emblematic of a government which is essentially acting in a unilateral way. Now, there might be some short-term wins in doing that, but in a long-term sustainable way, it is plain common sense that we are not going to be able to resolve this issue unless we are doing it cooperatively with our nearest neighbours, and particularly Indonesia. So I think there is a huge difference in relation to that.
When you think back to 2008, when Labor was first in power, there was a vast gulf between the two sides of politics on asylum seeker policy. The ALP itself has had to move a great distance, hasn't it, from those days?
I think the debate has changed within the community, and I think it is fair to observe that the debate has changed within the Labor Party as well. But I'd make this point back about where things were at in 2008, because there's a lot of revisionism which is going on by the government now. When policies were put in place to end the Pacific solution, there wasn't a whimper from the opposition, the then opposition at that time. The Coalition weren't jumping up and down. They acknowledged the mandate of the 2007 election. And I think the other point to understand is that this is a dynamic situation. The circumstances which present themselves in 2013-2014 are very different to what they were in 2001, both in terms of the number of people who are seeking refuge, but also the tactics that people smugglers are undertaking when they make the journey or procure the journey from Indonesia to Christmas Island. And so what John Howard put in place in 2001 I don't think would be working in 2013-14.
You mean the problems become more overwhelming?
Well, and I think the tactics have changed. We need to. It has been understood by the people smugglers that the offshore processing it was done under the Howard government essentially provided for a holding station for people, but those people basically ended up in Australia. Offshore processing now needs to be done in a different way. That's what the PNG arrangement does. If we're going to take Australia off the table, if you look at the turning back of boats during the Howard era, that was done in a sense for the first time, but raised the concerns then by Indonesia about it happening in an ongoing way. But now we're seeing that the pursuit of that policy by this government is having a very real impact on our relationship with Indonesia. And so circumstances change, policy needs to change with it. And I do think at the end of the day, the Labor Party has come up with, or came up in government with, the critical piece of public policy which made the difference, and that's the PNG arrangement. But one other point, I guess, in that observation about the changing nature of the debate, the loss of life at sea has profoundly changed this debate, both within the community and within the Labor Party. From a position of compassion and human rights, I personally have changed my attitude and now think that it is utterly essential that we stop the boats, because we simply can't afford to have that number of people drowning at sea. And it is obvious that the policies that we have in Australia play a part in whether or not people take the risk of getting on those boats. And so, you know, that is a game-changing phenomenon which we need to respond to.
What was your old attitude, and how hard was it personally for you to make that switch?
Well, I think, and I've spoken about this publicly before when we had these debates within the Labor Party at the time, I think that in the aftermath of 2001, we did not have the thinking that we needed to get this answer right. And the consequences of people losing their life at sea was something which clearly needed to be much more of a focus in the debate that we had. This was a terribly difficult issue for us in the aftermath of Tampa. I actually do think that during our time in government, the debate matured. I think we've got to the right place, but I think in the process of that, we also came up with policy prescriptions which are dealing with this issue in a contemporary way. And what we've got with the government now is that, in many respects, by parroting the lines of the Howard era, they've caught themselves in a time warp. They're presenting policy solutions which might have done whatever they did back then, but they're not what are going to make the difference now. Thankfully, this government, albeit quietly, is prosecuting Labor's PNG arrangement. That is what's making the difference.
Today, the Guardian Australia has revealed that the Immigration Department inadvertently put up the personal details of many thousands of asylum seekers on its website. Do you think this makes a big difference to how those individuals should be handled?
Well, this is an enormous breach in privacy. I think one of the biggest breaches we've seen in Australia's history in terms of privacy. It beggars belief that it could have happened. I mean, here we have a government which refuses to make public matters which should be made public and matters which should remain private, it has now put into the public domain. I mean, they can't even get the issue of secrecy right, even when they have a culture of secrecy. The implications for the people involved, I think, are going to flow now over the coming days as we work out what questions these raise and what situation it places these people in, and that's going to have a bit to do with the precise information that has been released in relation to each individual. But I think it's really important that we get to the bottom of how this happened, and I think it's obviously very important that the questions that are now raised in relation to those individuals. We're talking about near a third of the people who are in Australia right now seeking to be processed. Those questions need to be answered and answered quickly.
So many of those people, presumably, or quite a few of them, would be found when they were processed to not be refugees. The government would seek to repatriate them. Do you think that then problems of dangers in their home country arise?
Well, it varies on the circumstance of each of the persons in the country from which they come, and indeed in many cases the ethnicity that they have, and in terms of what situation they find in their home country. But putting those details out there is obviously an enormous concern for them, and I think we need to find out exactly what impact this has had on the legal situation of these people and what claims they might make within
our
system.
So this perhaps should be taken into account in their assessment?
Well, I think it's too early to make that statement, but clearly we need to get on top of the implications of this release of information. But this is a major mistake. It is ineptitude of a large order, and it comes from a government which has an appalling record in managing information.
Now, Labor appeared to me to go quite soft on the allegations by asylum seekers that they were mistreated by Navy personnel. And this is despite the fact that quite a substantial majority of Australians felt these should be investigated, these claims, according to a Nielsen poll. Why did you go so softly?
I wouldn't accept that. I mean, firstly, I do support what our Navy personnel, and I think it's very important that public representatives stand behind the Navy. I understand that in any instance of this kind, there would be an internal review in relation to exactly what has occurred in the incidents that have been reported. I think it's important that that be allowed to run its course. But I also do accept that, I think there are a whole lot of incentives that are in place for statements to be made about the way in which our Navy operates. And basically, I think our Navy operates very well. And so I don't think it's a question of going soft. I think it's about making sure that we are supporting our personnel who are doing a very difficult job out there and not putting ourselves in a position where we are allowing a campaign of that kind to undermine what is the very difficult work of ensuring that we do slow the process of boats coming from Indonesia.
So would you like to see whatever review has been done released publicly, or the minister make a detailed statement, or Angus Campbell make a detailed statement, the man in charge of the border security operation?
I do think that there is a valid point to make that the culture of secrecy that has been put over the whole of Operation Border Security is preventing, in many respects, the Navy from defending itself. I am sure that nothing untoward occurred here, but I do think it's important that the Navy is put in a position where it can defend itself. And so, in that sense, I think we would be well served if the government could have a better look at how it does that, so that these allegations can be contended.
So you would like a detailed statement from somebody official.
Well, I suppose what I would say is I don't think the way in which this has been handled in terms of an information management point of view has been helpful in terms of defending the Navy's position here. I mean, we all support where the Navy's at. It's important that the Navy is in a position to be able to defend itself in this circumstance.
But why are you convinced there's absolutely nothing in these allegations when they have been made in a quite detailed fashion? And we have seen some other sorts of incidents, different in kind, of course, sexual harassment and so on, where Navy personnel have behaved in a suboptimal way.
Well, I am sure in the sense that I think the Navy operate in a very professional and very appropriate manner when they perform the tasks that they do. I also think that there are a whole lot of motives surrounding why people might make claims of this kind. But I do accept the proposition that in order to deal with that, the Navy needs to be put in a position where it can defend itself. And I do think the way in which this government is managing its information and managing the reporting and handling of information around Operation Border Security is not helpful. And this culture of secrecy in this instance, I think, is getting in the way of the Navy being able to defend itself.
Just turning to the Labor Party generally, critics say that it is too negative, it's opposing everything the government is doing. Do you think that there's a danger going down this road, which after all worked very well for Tony Abbott, but circumstances now might be quite different? Do you think that Labor needs to be more selective in what it opposes?
I don't actually accept that we are opposing everything. I think it is important that we stand true to our ground. There was a significant debate around, for example, what position we ought to take in relation to the carbon tax, but I think it was important that we stay true to a position of supporting a pricing of carbon, albeit that the removal of the tax, or in other words, moving to a floating price at the earliest opportunity. I think it is very important that we articulate our own vision for the future, and we will do that as we go through the next 3 years in the lead up to the election. And I don't think we will get to where we want to get if all we do is oppose in the way that Tony Abbott did. And I think one of the issues which the Abbott government is now finding is that because it was in a sense a one-trick pony as an opposition, all it did was oppose things. Now that it's got to government, it's struggling to find a narrative for what it is about. And as we move towards the 2016 election, we are all very cognizant of the need to make sure that we have a narrative, a positive narrative, of what a future shortened government would look like and what we would do and what we would seek to do. Now, along the way, you've got to hold the government to account, and we'll continue to do that, and we're not going to be afraid in doing that. But, you know, it is important to have that narrative as part of our strategy, and we will.
Well, you have a mini election we expect coming up with the Western Australian Senate poll having a rerun. What will be Labor's narrative for that election?
Well, I think the way in which the economy is being managed right now is obviously of critical importance and concern to the people of Australia. We're watching a real hemorrhaging in manufacturing in Australia, and we're watching a government which is quite indifferent about the way in which it goes about the managing of jobs. I think that's going to be an important issue. Health and education, of course, are always important issues. I think the other point is that in so many areas, the Abbott government is not the government they promised to be. What they said prior to the election and what they've done since are two very different things. And so that basic integrity of meeting the mandate that you sought, I think we are holding the government to account on that, but I think that is a critical issue out there, and I'm sure it will resonate in WA.
Just on the whole manufacturing question, of course, we've had the announcement this week of Alcoa shutting down. That hits your electorate of Corio in Victoria. When Labor's putting together a manufacturing policy, do you think it should go in the direction of economic rationalism, or should it go in a more interventionist direction?
We're believers in the market. We always have been. But we think government does have a role in relation to that. And we've always thought that, particularly in terms of developing a country's capability, its technological capability, the role of government is very significant. Science infrastructure, as an example of that, has always been largely a matter of in the public domain, and it has been responsible for the significant advancement of Western society. Isaac Newton worked on the public purse at Cambridge University. So we do see that there is a role for government in relation to this, and that goes to industry policy as well. One of the concerns that I have about the indifference, almost active encouragement of this government to see the end of the car industry in Australia, is that it's our highest tech manufacturing that we do. This is not some old industry consigned to developing countries. It's actually a really important industry which you find at the heart of the serious modern economies in the world, like places like Germany, Japan, Britain, the States. We don't have that anymore, or we won't. The idea that we are a country which will in the future be unable to make cars, I think, is deeply concerning. Now, making cars in the developed world is in essence a public-private partnership in all the countries that I've just mentioned, and so we do think that there is a role for government in terms of entering into a partnership of that kind. So we absolutely believe in the market, but it's not a fundamentalist economic flat earth view, which you'll see from the conservatives at the moment, which actually I think puts them in the broad spectrum of conservative politics around the world on the extreme edge.
So you think if Labor had been in office another couple of terms, we really would still have a car industry in Australia at the end of that?
I actually do. We can never know. That's the first thing. And so I accept that it's conjecture. And I think that in relation to each company has its own story, and so in relation to some companies it will be different to others. But I absolutely believe that when we're talking about the car industry specifically, that had we won the last election, we would have been able to keep the car industry. And the reason I say that is because we went to the last election with, in essence, $1 billion different proposition from the coalition about the future of the car industry. Now, at the time, it seemed to me that that really represented the difference between having a car industry or not. Even I didn't think we would have the answer to that question within a few months, as it has now played out. But it did seem to me that that was the inevitable consequence of the position that the Abbott government took to the last election. Well, that is how it's played out. You know, correspondingly, I think the position that we took to the last election would have kept the car industry here.
So you would like to see industry policy as one of the defining differences between the two sides at the 2016 election?
Oh, well, I think it is a defining difference, and I absolutely agree with that. And I think in saying that, it's not any move away from the open economy which Labor built under the Hawke-Keating years. Of course, in those days, the tariff protection on vehicles was enormous, and it's much less now, and we've been a part of championing that. But even with that, countries around the world, making cars is a public-private partnership. In countries around the world, in modern economies, having a manufacturing industry is a conscious decision of government. It would be our conscious decision. It is clearly a conscious decision of the Abbott government to let it go, and there will be enormous consequences to us at a human level, which obviously I've seen in my electorate over the last few days. But in terms of the capacity, the technological ability of this country, we are going to witness a de-skilling of Australia, and that's not the prescription for taking us into the 21st century.
Within the Labor Party in the next year or two, there are going to be some substantial debates about how far democracy within the ALP should be taken. What's your view on this, and do you agree with the proposition that Anthony Albanese put the other day that Senate candidates should be elected by the rank and file? We've seen often, or usually even, factional deals to tie up these positions.
I have an open mind specifically about the Senate. I wouldn't go as far as where Anthony has gone in what he said in relation to the Senate. I do think more generally the step that we took after the last election in having our leadership determined in part by a vote of the membership was a very good thing, and it has it saw an enormous engagement in that decision, but correspondingly a really good positive sense of ownership, I think, that the party membership has in relation to Bill, you know, that they feel that he is their representative and not just the leader of the parliamentary party, but the leader of the Labor Party, and that's a fantastic platform for Bill and obviously for us as his team going forward. So, and I think there is room to talk about how we can apply the lessons that we've learned there and the experience that we had there to other parts of the Labor Party. There's no doubt we need to open up. That as a general proposition, I completely agree with. The specifics of that,
but
I think we've
sort
got to
of
work
heard
through.
That since Adam was a boy, haven't we?
Yeah, but we did make a more substantive step down that path in the aftermath of the last election than we perhaps ever have. And it really was a very courageous step, I think, to do that. And it was a very good thing. You know, having gone through that experience and maybe being a little sceptical in the lead up to it, watching the way in which party members reacted to it, I'm absolutely a believer that this was a positive thing. And I do think we need to look at ways in which that can be applied across the board.
But let's face it, that exercise in democracy, opening up the leadership to the rank and file as well as the caucus members, was driven by the very special circumstances of Kevin Rudd being removed, and when he came back he was determined to ensure that he was never going to be vulnerable again if he won the election. So it wasn't really some high-minded view of the Labor Party, was it?
I wouldn't necessarily accept that narrative, but even if that is the narrative, it's happened, and it's happened in relation to the most important position in the Labor Party, namely the federal leader, the leader of the Australian Labor Party. If it can apply to that, the question then is, well, what can't it apply to? Now, I think that's a discussion to be had. I think there are going to be different circumstances in relation to each position. I think it does need to be worked through carefully. The next Labor Party conference, national conference, is obviously when a lot of this will come to the fore, and I think it's got to be a careful process. But I have no doubt that something has been opened in that in what we did after the election, and I think this is a moment to be grabbed.
Now, just finally, you had a rather torrid time yourself in the last term. You were a very strong Rudd supporter. You had to quit a front bench position over some of the leadership shenanigans. How do you find the contrast between last term and being in opposition?
Well, it's better to be in government, I can assure you of that, and we are doing everything we can to make this as short a stay in opposition as possible. Having said that, I mean, there is a totally different sense within the caucus today to what there was last year. It's a relief is what it's like, and there is a sense of unity around Bill's leadership. There is a sense of unity in what we need to do, and you know, we could spend probably a number of podcasts on the history of what happened with the contests between Kevin and Julia, and look, I think both made an enormous contribution to our party, and they need to be celebrated. But going forward, the fact that there is really strong unity within our team now is a relief, but it's a great thing, and it's absolutely at the heart of whatever success we might have in the future. So I think there's a very strong commitment to it going forward.
Richard Miles, thank you very much.
Thanks, Michelle.
That was Richard Miles, Labor's immigration spokesman. That's all today from the Conversation Politics podcast. Thanks to my producer, Matt Dawson. I'm Michelle Grattan. Talk to you next time.